This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
The world natural gas shortage and the skyrocketing prices shine a light on the difficult path we have towards a survivable climate. On the one hand, no one wants to see people go cold or hungry during a tough winter. But we have to stop burning fossil fuels to survive in the future. Europeans have adapted to their winters before, as you know, as wars or depression brought on very hard times. People wore extra sweaters or even coats indoors. But now we have a new factor, as outlined by Judah Cohen and others, including Jennifer Francis of Rutgers. Here's the story. In the past, a strong barrier of upper atmosphere wind, the polar vortex, kept severe Arctic cold contained within polar regions. That wind results from the difference between the heat in the tropics and cold at the poles. But in recent decades, the Arctic has warmed so much, there is less difference in temperature. So the wind guardrail breaks, letting super cold sweep down into the northern U.S., North Europe, and parts of Siberia and North China. That may not happen every winter. It may not happen this winter. But so far, signs in Siberian snow, low Arctic sea ice, and the arrival of the Pacific cold water pattern La Niña all point towards excursions of the polar vortex southwards. And these frigid cold zones can get stuck or blocked over land for longer periods. This may not be your grandfather's winter anymore. Extreme rains are flooding the earth. Actually, only part of that is true. Recently, with UCLA guest Jesse Norris, scientists confidently confirm extreme precipitation events are increasing in recent decades. The trouble is, despite vivid media footage of cars floating down the streets, the actual numbers of floods do not show a corresponding increase. Why not? To plan the future and understand possible disasters, we have new science with an explanation and a warning. Our guide is the lead author of the new study, Dr. Manuela Brunner, got her master's in climate sciences at the University of Bern, Switzerland, and then a doctorate of geography at the University of Zurich. Now she is a lecturer at the University of Freiburg in Germany, focusing on hydrological extremes and water resources. From Freiburg, Manuela Brunner, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, everyone, and thanks for having me, Alex.
This problem you study, it runs against common sense. If the planet is experiencing more extreme precipitation, of course there must be more floods. Why would you question that?
The thing is, while you would expect increasing precipitation to lead to increases in flooding, we don't necessarily see this behavior in our short observational records. This means that there's limited observational evidence of increases in flooding, and that's just because we might not be looking at the extreme events where increases in precipitation do actually lead to increases in flooding.
All right, so could you take a little bit of time to unfold your team's explanation for this paradox? I mean, is it just a matter of we don't have good enough observations, or is there something else at work here when it comes to how heavy rains do or do not lead to more flooding?
What we show in our study is that there's actually some severity threshold above which we do see increases in flooding as a response to increases in extreme precipitation, and below which we see a decrease or just weak changes in flooding as a response to increases in precipitation. And we see these two different types of responses for moderate and very severe extreme events, because if we look at moderate extreme precipitation events, the role of the soil or the soil state plays an important role too. So imagine you have a rather dry soil and you start adding a little bit of precipitation. Initially, that precipitation can be absorbed by the dry soil, but this absorptive capacity has a certain limit above which the increases in precipitation will trigger some sort of a runoff or a stream flow response. Now imagine that you keep adding more and more water, and at some point you're going to produce a flood event. Now if your precipitation event is just moderate, the increase in precipitation might not necessarily lead to an increase in flooding because the soil can absorb part of the precipitation event. If, however, you're talking about very extreme precipitation events, the soil state does no longer matter because the moisture you're adding through the precipitation event is so large that in any case, the precipitation event will trigger some flood event. So it's all about the pre-existing conditions in combination with the rainfall event, which means that it's not just about the precipitation increases, but the soil state matters too.
Well, we have a very strange relationship here with climate change because the warming climate means the atmosphere can hold more water, so we're more likely to get extreme precipitation events. But at the same time, the heating may dry out the soil, so that creates a buffer that almost hides some of those extreme rains instead of letting them become a flood. Is that right?
That's exactly true. So climate change has this twofold effect on flooding. It, on the one hand, influences soil moisture states, and the soil drying leads to the fact that more rain can potentially be absorbed, which can lead potentially to decreases in flooding for just moderate precipitation extremes. Well, if we're looking at the very extreme events, the soil moisture states no longer matter a lot, and the increasingly intense precipitation will translate into flooding eventually.
I like the way one of your co-authors, Daniel Swain, he runs the well-known Twitter feed Weather West, and he said this about it: the result is striking since it suggests that while smaller floods may decrease, the largest and most destructive floods will likely increase, meaning the sign of flood hydrologic response to climate change likely depends on event intensity. It's a little bit tricky to understand. What does he mean by event intensity determining the outcome?
With event intensity, he means basically the magnitude of the precipitation event. So imagine you're looking at a very severe precipitation event, for example, the one that just happened recently in July in Germany, or think about a precipitation event such as the one that triggered the Tennessee flooding also just recently. If you have such high-intensity events, we would in future expect an increase in flooding as a response of increases in such intense precipitation events, while if you consider some more moderate precipitation event increases, such as, you know, events you would maybe observe once a year or every second year, you might not necessarily see an increase in flooding as a response to these moderate events. And with intensity, he just meant basically the difference between these moderate, regular, extreme precipitation events and more severe, very rare precipitation events that happen maybe twice a century or even less often.
Well, I could see how this is important because if we imagine a government planner who sees more extreme rains but not anything unusual in floods, so why would the government spend millions on flood protection when so far not much new has happened? What does your work tell those planners and all of us, really?
What our work can tell those planners is that by just looking at observed trends in flood magnitudes, we might underestimate future changes in flood magnitudes. Because our observations, they're typically short time series, and in these short time series, we observe more of these moderate extreme precipitation events, those that might in some cases even decrease in future, while they contain very few of these high intensity and very extreme events we're actually interested in, and these are the high impact events. And if we just look at the observations, we don't necessarily see the increases in those high-intensity events we're expecting in the future and which we also see in our large ensemble simulations.
Right. For that simulation, your team used the catchment basin of three rivers in Bavaria, including the headwaters of the Danube, I think. So did you find a flood threshold for extreme rain flooding there?
Yes, we demonstrate that there's this severity or extremeness threshold above which we expect increases in flooding as a response to increases in precipitation, and below which soil is an important modulator of changes in future flooding. And we use 78 different catchments in the headwaters of the Main and Danube catchments in southern Germany. And for these catchments, we show that there is such a threshold. The exact location of the severity or extremeness threshold can vary depending on catchment elevation, on season, or also on catchment size.
Manuela, you know the United States. In November 2020, you delivered a webinar on regional floods in the U.S. You worked as a postdoc researcher at NCAR, the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research. Can we transfer your results in Germany to the United States? And if so, what are the lessons for our American listeners?
We think that the results we find in southern Germany are to some degree transferable to the United States, especially those regions that are characterized by humid, temperate climates. The exact location of the threshold might vary a bit depending on the climate zone. For example, it might lie a bit higher in drier regions, such as the Great Plains, because there the capacity of the soil to absorb precipitation might be a little higher. Then the location of the threshold might also be a bit different in heavily urbanized areas, because there we have to consider that the urban area is characterized by sealed and impermeable soils, and there or increases in flooding might be a very direct response of increases in precipitation, because the soil can really hardly absorb any moisture. And such urban catchments were not really included in our German catchment selection. And therefore, for those catchments that are heavily urbanized, we would expect a much more direct relationship between increases in precipitation and flooding than we saw in our German case study catchments.
Could we develop a warning system partly by just monitoring the amount of water already soaked into our landscape so we'd know what it can take?
You could certainly monitor soil wetness and take that as an indicator for the risk of flooding given a certain rainfall forecast. This is currently also part of the current flood forecasting systems, and we've known that soil moisture is an important flood driver for a long time, so this is definitely something that is being considered when we do flood forecasting.
On this new study, it's just one of a part of a series of peer-reviewed papers you led this year. One is directly about, quote, challenges in modeling and predicting floods and droughts. How far along are we in being able to predict when these life-changing events are coming or what to expect as the world warms?
Well, if we're talking more about forecasts, so basically the prediction of events happening in the next few days, we've definitely made some advances in the recent years in terms of the flood forecasting chains. However, if you want to look beyond forecasts of a few days, the weather system is very chaotic and predictions are increasingly difficult, but what we've definitely come up with is good information chains where initial conditions, for example, the conditions of the soil, can readily be updated in order to forecast future or upcoming flood events more reliably than we used to be able to do a few years ago.
I've seen several examples. I remember one from East Africa where there was a long period of drought and then suddenly a burst of extreme rains and the whole place just flooded out. And we also have the example of Pakistan, which is a very dry place, but in 2010, about a third of the country flooded, an amazing event. I think we need more study on what really happened there. It kind of got lost. But you have, in your work, looked at how a region shifts from a long, dry regime to a sudden burst of extreme rains. Is it important to understand those transition times?
Definitely important to look at also drought to flood transitions, which is important in terms of management. Imagine you're in this long dry period and your management is really targeted at alleviating the current drought conditions. This might lead, for example, to water storage in reservoirs. But now imagine that your dry condition is suddenly transferring into a rather wet condition, and because you're saving all that water in the reservoir, you're no longer able to store additional flood water in order to alleviate the flood condition. So being able to understand this interplay between dry and flood conditions is very important, such that you can anticipate potential management options and don't run into the situation where you've optimized the system for one conditions but forgot about the potential happening of the other condition.
Well, that totally makes sense. And you say the time scale is key to understanding hot, dry events, the time scale. But to be honest, I read the paper and I still don't really get why. I didn't get it. Can you help us out on that?
Well, the time matters because of impacts. So imagine you have a 1 month hot dry event and you might be able to get some water from somewhere to ensure water supply. You might still be able to get some water from a neighboring region to irrigate your fields to rescue the harvest. However, if your event lasts a whole year, it might be much more difficult to get water from other places or to store water somewhere in the catchment such that you can bridge a whole year of low water availability. So the time scale is essential in terms of water management because the longer the event, the more difficult it is to find enough water to ensure water supply in all the different sectors.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest from the University of Freiburg is research scientist Manuela Brunner. We're talking about extremes in the water cycle, from drought to record rains and floods. If we're looking at things that happen over decades and we're drawing out charts of the slow development of climate change, and then we have these large excursions, these big blips of extreme rains and very great heat, do they really show up in the climate models? It looks to me like you had to develop or use a climate model from another university, a fairly new technology, to really pick up what is going on. I wonder if that means advice to governments or even the IPCC are sometimes too generalized to pick up extreme events. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's true. These very extreme events or the exceptional types of events, they only show up in parts of the simulation. So what we did in this study is that we ran a climate model several times with different initial conditions to generate a large ensemble of stream flow time series, which hopefully contain some of these very severe or exceptional events we are interested in. And it is true, if you just run your climate model once, you might not be depicting the whole variability of your phenomenon. So you might be missing out on certain extreme events, which you could potentially observe, but we're just not necessarily simulating them if we're feeding the model with just one potential realization of temperature or precipitation. So in order to look at the whole variability in stream flow, we want to feed our hydrological model several times with different types of temperature and precipitation time series, such that among the simulated events, we'll have a few that are exceptional and we can use to study these very extreme events.
If there is a hydrological threshold where extreme rainfall breaks into extreme flooding, can we discover what that threshold is for different places and how would it help?
We can discover the location of this severity threshold above which increases in precipitation translate to increases in flooding by running a large number of climate simulations, which can then be again fed into a hydrological model. And this large ensemble of climate and hydrological simulations will allow us to study the location of this extremeness or severity threshold.
In a different field, fire experts stress the key to forest recovery after a fire is the interval of time before the next fire arrives. If fire returns within 3 to 5 years, regrowth may be killed right off. How does the return interval work in your studies of extreme rains and floods? Is it important?
Yes, definitely. We quantify this severity threshold in terms of a return period. That means that we show that for events that happen less frequently than every 20 to 50 years, we see a relatively direct relationship between increases in precipitation and increases in flooding, while for more frequent events with return periods of 10 years or 5 years, we might not necessarily see increases in flooding as a response to increases in extreme precipitation. So that means we just use the return period as a proxy for event rareness or event severity.
I find the importance of land and geography is often left out of climate stories. We talk about atmosphere, oceans, solar energy, winds. Your work brings back the role of landscape, soil, and rivers into weather and climate change. Would you agree?
Yes, definitely. I'm a hydrologist, and that's basically our task, to show that it's not just about what's happening in the atmosphere, but that there's a lot of important processes on the land surface that shape the behavior of the water cycle, too. So we kind of go beyond atmospheric sciences and couple what's happening in the atmosphere with what's happening at the land surface.
And when you get questions like what caused this drought or this heat wave, do you find people are looking for a single answer, really, and avoiding complexity? For example, what is a compound event, and can you give us a case of it?
A compound event is an event where not just one variable is affected, but actually several variables are affected at once, and these variables might also interact with each other. So let's make an example. For example, if you're looking at a compound hot dry event, we're talking about an event where precipitation is very low and at the same time temperature is very high. So we have this precipitation anomaly combined with a precipitation anomaly and talk about compound events. So it's really about events where we're not just looking at temperature or just at precipitation, but we're considering the two variables at the same time and are interested in situations where both of them show a dry or hot anomaly respectively.
Well, when it comes to a flood threshold, it seems almost like there's a trap here. We may get lulled into complacency by floods that are within normal records. Do you think that as the world warms, society could face flooding on unprecedented scales, disasters beyond our experience?
This is definitely possible. I mean, we've just had the recent example in Germany, in Rhineland-Pfalz, where we've seen an exceptional precipitation event, or it was also exceptional in terms of intensity, but what made it really exceptional was its large spatial extent. And as such, this event came kind of unexpected, but we're always going to see such unexpected events, and they're going to become more likely as we move into a warmer future.
After talking with a few hundred scientists, I am worried about the future and what we are leaving our kids and grandchildren on a personal level. Are you worried, or are you still optimistic?
Well, I'm optimistic in the sense that we can still do something against it. We can still determine in some way how strong the future changes in climate and the hydrological cycle are going to be. But I'm kind of also a little bit pessimistic in the sense that we cannot go back to where we were 30 years ago, because we've already started to warm the atmosphere, and the changes we are currently seeing can no longer be removed. So what we can just do is to reduce emissions, or to change maybe our behavior such that the changes are smaller than they would be if we kept emitting as we're emitting right now.
Yes, I would say it's looking bad, but we can still avoid the worst. So no doubt you're already looking at other problems to solve with science. Manuela, what are you working on these days?
These days I'm looking at the direct human impact on hydrological extremes. That means floods and droughts. And by direct human impact, I mean more direct impact on the water cycle than maybe changes in climate, such as reservoir regulations or water abstractions or other types of water regulation.
From Freiburg in Breisgau, Germany, we have been speaking with lecturer and research scientist Manuela Brunner. She has published a series of papers on the hydrology of Earth, from drought to extreme rains and floods. You can find links to Manuela's website and all the science we just talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Manuela, thank you for sharing your valuable work with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
For Radio EcoShock, I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.